8. Augur shuttle hauled away from the 20th Century Limited and aimed itself in the general direction of Mars. She pressed her face against the glass of a porthole, feeling the vibration in her bones as the shuttle stammered its steering jets in rapid, chugging sequence. Though she had little idea of where she was being taken, or how her task fitted into the story Peter had told her, she was still glad to leave the clapped-out old space liner. After 5 days, its charms had worn perilously thin, with even a guided tour into the ship's bowels to view the last working antimatter engine in the solar system, providing little more than an hour's mildly diverting and frankly terrifying entertainment. Mars, at least, was ripe with possibility, and she felt a tingling sense of anticipation as the planet's butterscotch face loomed larger. It wasn't just lack of funds that had kept her from visiting Mars before. She reckoned there was something ghoulish about the tourists who did make the trip, some morbid craving to revel in the horror of what had happened to the planet. But now that she had been sent here on someone else's orders, it was difficult not to want to see it for herself. The scoured zone began south of the Hellas Planitia and had reached as far north as Cydonia, encompassing all of the crater-pocked uplands of the Arabia Terra. Between the poles, the rest of Mars was dusted in shades of brittle blue-green. Vast prairies of hardy, gene-tweaked vegetation laid down over 100 years earlier. Canals, etched across the surface with laser precision, were twinkling back ribbons of reflected sunlight. At the hubs and junctions of the irrigation system, Augur made out the off-white sprawl of cities and townships, the tentative scratches of roads and the lines of tethered dirigibles. There were even a few wispy streaks of cloud, and a handful of hexagonal lakes, clustered together like cells in a beehive. Between the Hellas Planitia and Cydonia, nothing grew, nothing endured, nothing lived or moved. Even the mindless clouds exhibited a wary disregard for that whole area. It had been that way for 23 years, since the last days of the brief but bitter war that had erupted between the Slashers and the Threshers over rights of access to Earth. Augur barely remembered the war. As a child, she had been cosseted from the worst of the news. But it really hadn't been all that long ago, and there was still a sense that certain scores had yet to be settled. She thought of Caliscan, losing a brother to the Slashers in the battle to reclaim Phobos. The war must have seemed like yesterday to him. How could he accept Slasher involvement in Earth so readily after what they had taken from him? How could he be so cold, so political? Another series of maneuvers followed, smoother this time, and then, quite without warning, Augur found her view of the scoured zone obstructed by the illuminated, machine-lined walls of a docking bay, sliding slowly past. Beyond the bay, glimpsed for an instant, was a curving, airless horizon of very dark rock. She had been misinformed about Mars. It had never been her destination. The welcoming party on the other side of the airlock consisted of 8 men and women in Usni military uniform, accompanied by 2 snake robots.
"I'm Aveling," said the tallest, thinnest man in the group, observing Augur with pale aluminium-grey eyes. He had a ruined voice, a slow, parched rasp that she had to strain to understand.
"You'll be taking orders and instructions from me for the duration of your mission. If that's a problem, get over it now."
"And if I don't get over it?" she asked.
"We'll put you on the first ship back to Tanglewood, and that unpleasant little tribunal you should be facing."
"Only with half my memory missing," she said.
"Correct.
If it's all right with you, I'll try the taking orders thing for now. See how that works out."
"Fine,"
Aveling said. He had the look of a serious, hard bastard, the kind who was even more intimidating because he appeared intelligent and cultured, while also giving off the unavoidable impression that he could kill anyone in the room before they'd taken their next breath. She had been told nothing about him, but she knew instantly that he was a veteran of the war, and that he had probably killed more Slashers than she had met in her life, and that he had probably never missed a night's sleep because of it.
"I'd still really like someone to tell me what I'm doing on Phobos," Augur said, as Aveling's party led her away from the shuttle, with 2 snake robots slithering along behind.
"What do you know about Phobos?"
Aveling said. He sounded as if his voice box had been stitched back together from tatters, reconstructed like a shredded document.
"I know to keep away, Other than that, not much. Mars is basically civilian, but you military boys have the moon sewn up pretty tight.
The moons offer the perfect strategic platform for defending the planet against slasher incursions. Given the existing security measures already in place, they're also a perfect venue for conducting any sensitive business that might come our way.
Do I count as sensitive business?
No, Augur. You count as a pain in the ass. If there's one thing I hate more than civilians, it's having to be nice to them.
You mean this is you being nice? They led Augur to a small windowless chamber with a couple of closed doors leading away into other rooms. The room contained three seats, a low table and a flagon of water, accompanied by two glasses. A grey cabinet occupied one wall, crammed with magnetic tapes in white plastic spools, with a female hopper set next to it. They left her alone. Augur poured herself a glass of water and sipped at it experimentally. She had finished half the glass when one of the other doors whisked open and a short, tough-looking woman entered. She had an efficient, low-maintenance bob of straw-colored hair, framing a face that might have been pretty, except for the scowl that seemed molded into it. She wore coveralls with many pockets and loops, the top zipped low enough to reveal a grubby white T-shirt beneath. Quick, intelligent eyes appraised Augur. The woman took the stub of a cigarette from her lips and flicked it into one corner of the room.
Verity, right?
Yes, she said cautiously. The woman leaned down, rubbed one hand against her thigh, and then offered it to Augur.
Moria Skelskart, have those pricks been treating you all right?
Well, Augur began, suddenly lost for words. Skelskart sat down on one of the other seats and helped herself to some water. What you have to understand about those people, and believe me, it took me a while to arrive at this conclusion, is that you're better with them than without them. Aveling is a cold-hearted son of a bitch, but he's our cold-hearted son of a bitch.
Are you military? Augur asked.
Skelskart downed her glass of water in one gulp, then poured another.
Hell no! I'm just a snotty-nosed academic. Until a year ago, I was happily minding my own business, trying to come up with a mathematical treatment of pathological matter.
Anticipating Augur's question, she continued, "The normal mathematics of wormhole mechanics says you need something called exotic matter to enlarge and stabilize a wormhole throat. That's matter with negative energy density. Already seriously weird stuff. But as soon as we got our hands on a few crumbs of intelligence about the hyperweb, it became clear that this wasn't really a wormhole in the classical sense. Pretty soon we realized we needed something several degrees weirder than exotic matter to make it hang together. Hence, pathological matter." She shrugged. "We're physicists. You have to allow us our little jokes, no matter how piss-poor they are."
"It's all right," Augur said. "You should hear some of the jokes archaeologists think are funny."
"I guess we're both in the same boat, then. A pair of pain-in-the-ass civilian experts Aveling has no choice but to work with." Augur smiled. "That guy just loves civilians, doesn't he?"
"Oh, yes. Can't get enough of them."
Skelskart emptied her glass a second time. Her knuckles were barked and grazed, dark crescents of grime caked under her very short fingernails. "I heard about the tribunal. Sounds as if they've got you by the short and curlies."
"I deserve it. I nearly killed a boy."
Skelskart waved that away. "They'll fix him if his family's as rich and influential as I heard they are."
"Well, I hope they do fix him. He wasn't a bad kid.
What about you? I heard that you're married to Peter Augur."
"Was married to him," Augur corrected.
Please don't tell me Mr. Perfect is really a pig behind closed doors. I don't think I could stand having my illusions shattered."
"No,"
Augur said wearily. "Peter's a decent enough man. Not perfect, not bad either. I was the problem, not him. I let my work take over.
I hope it was worth it.
What else? Any kids? A boy and a girl I love very much, but who I don't make enough time for." Skelskart looked sympathetic. "I guess that must have simplified things when it came to Kaliskan's nice little offer."
"They'd have thrown away the key," Augur said. "Put me somewhere like Venus Deep. By the time I got to see my kids again, they'd have barely recognized me. At least this way I have a chance of coming through this with my life at least vaguely intact."
She shifted in her seat, uneasy about discussing her private life. "Of course,
It might help if I knew what the hell it is I'm supposed to do.
Skelskad regarded her shrewdly. What have they told you so far?
They told me about the slasher intelligence on the ALS objects, Auger replied.
Good. That's a start, at least.
They said they'd found a way into one. They also told me I was supposed to go inside. I guess Phobos has something to do with that.
More than a little. About 2 years ago, the Usni found an inactive portal right here, buried under a couple of kilometers of Phobos topsoil. That was when I was drafted onto the team. And the closest thing to an expert on hyperweb travel outside of the polities, which, I hasten to add, isn't saying much, but at least now we have a real one to play with.
And you've made it work.
As long as you don't mind the bumpy ride.
And the slashers still know nothing about it. How come they didn't find it when they were running Phobos?
They didn't look deep enough. We only stumbled on it by accident when we were excavating a new living chamber.
Auger suddenly felt very awake and very alert. I want to see it.
Good. That was sort of the idea of bringing you here in the first place.
Skelskad hitched up a frayed sleeve to glance at her watch. We'd better get a move on. There's an incoming transport due any minute.
I still don't know what Paris has to do with all this.
We'll come to that, Skelskad said. The chamber was large and very nearly spherical, the incurving walls gouged and blasted from cold dark Phobos core material and then sprayed with some kind of plastic onto which platforms, lighting rigs, and catwalks had been bolted or glued. Occupying much of the interior was a glass sphere about half as wide as the chamber, supported in a complex cradle of B-striped struts and shock-absorbing pistons. Catwalks, caged ladders, pipes, and conduits wrapped the sphere in a gristle of metal and plastic. White-clad technicians perched at various locations around the sphere, tapping equipment into open access ports. With their headphones, goggles, and gloves, they looked like safe crackers engaged in some spectacular heist.
We're just in time, Skelskad said, consulting an instrument-crammed panel bolted to one bar of the viewing cage in which they stood. Transport hasn't come through yet, but we're already picking up bow shock distortion ahead of it. On the panel, the needles on numerous analog dials were twitching into the red. Looks like it was a rough ride. Hope they packed their bath bags.
The technicians had cleared out of the area around the recovery bubble. Machines moved into different positions. Auger even noticed three snake robots in defensive-offensive postures, poised like spitting cobras.
They expecting something nasty? She asked.
Just a precaution, Skelskad said. Once that ship's in the pipe, we can't communicate with it or the remote portal at E2. That's a 30-hour communications blackout. It makes us twitchy.
And why is that?
Theory says there's no way that the slashers could tap into this leg of the hyperweb, even if they knew it existed. But theory might be wrong. Also, we're defending against the possibility that the E2 portal might have been compromised by what the military boys are calling indigenous E2 hostiles.
The needles on the analog dials jammed hard into the red. From somewhere beyond the bubble, shining through it with X-ray intensity, came a cruel blue light, brighter than the sun.
Auger turned away, holding a hand over her eyes. She could make out the sketchy anatomical shadows of her finger bones. As quickly as it had arrived, the light was gone, leaving only a tracery of pink afterimages on her retinas. Through pained eyes, Auger squinted at the bubble just in time to see a blur of motion as the incoming transport arrived. The ship rammed into the cradle like a piston. The cradle lurched, cushioning the deceleration. This happened in absolute silence. Then the cradle reached the limit of its motion, and the entire glass bubble bulged visibly, compressing its huge pneumatic supports with an enormous steely groan, followed by a slow, sighing relaxation back to its original position.
You keep mentioning E2, Auger said. Is that supposed to mean something to me?
Earth 2, Skelskad said, without batting an eyelid. Somewhere, the vacuum integrity of the bubble had been breached. Air shrieked into it, the breeze already tugging at Auger's hair. Klaxons and warning lights went berserk. Auger renewed her grip on the cage's support railing. The white-suited technicians were already scurrying back to their posts.
That looked rough, Auger remarked.
They'll live, Skelskad replied.
Has anyone not lived?
Once, back when we were still ironing out glitches in the system, it wasn't pretty, but we've learnt a few things since then. The transport began to descend, passing into some kind of enclosed structure nestling in the base of the bubble. Doors sealed it from view.
Come on, Skelskart said. Let's take a closer look.
Auger followed her through a network of caged ladders down to the lower level. The glass bulb of the bubble loomed over them. It had been patched and sealed in many areas, with fresh star-shaped floors marked and dated in luminous paint. All this was built in a year.
It's been 2 years since they found the portal, Skelskart said. Hey, give the military guys some credit. They did make some progress before I came on the team, even if most of it consisted of poking the portal with a series of increasingly large sticks.
All the same, I'm still pretty impressed.
Well, don't be. We've been as clever as we can be, but we couldn't have achieved any of this without a healthy dose of slasher know-how. And I don't just mean the kind of intelligence we got from Peter.
What other kind is there?
Technical assistance, Skelskart said. Contraband technology. Not just the obvious stuff like the robots, but control gear, cybernetics, nanotech, all the stuff we need to interface with the pathological matter mechanisms of the original portal.
How did you steal that kind of thing?
We didn't. We asked nicely and we got it.
Beneath the bubble, the newly arrived transport emerged from the airlock structure, lowering on a piston-driven platform. The cylindrical craft was shaped like an artillery shell, its skin a rococo crawl of complex pewter-colored machinery. There was evidence of damage. Hinged banks of machinery packed around the cylinder were either mangled or missing entirely, sheared off, leaving patches of bright metal. Various panels and ports had been ripped free, exposing scorched, frayed viscera of wiring and fuel lines. The whole thing still smelled faintly of burning oil.
Told you it was a rough crossing, Skelskart said, but she should be good for another round trip, once we get her patched up again.
How many trips did it take for her to get into that state?
One, but it's not usually that bad.
The ship slid sideways on its platform. Two of the three snake robots slinked over to it, weapons and sensors popping out of their head spheres. A gang of white-clad technicians were already fussing over the transport, plugging bits of equipment into it and making cautious hand gestures to each other. One of them shone a torch into the dark patch that was one of the cabin windows. Meanwhile, one of four intact transports slid over from a storage rack, guided by other technicians. Auger watched as it moved up into the airlock, disappearing and then reappearing inside the recovery bubble, with its nose aimed towards the far wall. The pressure leak had already been fixed, and most of the klaxons had now fallen silent. Odd as it seemed, it all had the feeling of business as usual.
What'll happen now? Auger asked.
They'll run some pre-flight checks, some tests on the ship and the weather conditions in the link. If everything behaves itself, we'll be looking at an insertion in about 6 hours.
Insertion? Auger repeated thoughtfully, looking at the blunt machine and the narrowing shaft it was aimed at.
It's all very phallic, isn't it?
I know, Skelskart said confidingly, but what can you do? The boys must have their toys.
She opened the cabinet and pulled out two white smocks. She passed one to Auger and donned the other one, closing the Velcro seams tightly.
Let's see how they're doing, shall we?
With the snake robot still monitoring events, the technicians used a variety of heavy-duty tools to open the ship's airlock. It finally gave way with a gasp of equalizing air pressure, then swung open and aside on complex hinges. Warm red light spilled from the interior of the transport. One of the technicians climbed aboard, then re-emerged a minute or two later, accompanied by a cropped-haired woman dressed in what looked like the interior layer of an environment suit. The woman supported one arm with the other, as if she had fractured or broken a bone. A man emerged behind her, his face pale and drawn, etched with what looked like years of fatigue. Skelskart pushed through the retinue of technicians and spoke briefly to the two passengers before giving them both a reassuring hug. A medical team had appeared from somewhere and began fussing over the two arrivals as soon as Skelskart had finished with them.
They had it pretty rough, she told Auger. Hit some bad throat turbulence during the insertion at the other end, but they'll live, which is what matters.
I thought hyperweb travel was supposed to be routine.
It is,
if you have the experience that the Slashers do. But we've only been doing this for a year. They can squeeze a liner through their portals and not touch the sides. For us, it's a major headache just to get one of these dinky little ships through in one piece. What were you saying about Slasher technology just now? How can there be Slasher involvement with this, if you say they don't even know about this place? We have our share of sympathizers amongst moderate Slashers, people who think the aggressive expansionism needs a moderating influence. Defectors and traitors, Auger said scornfully.
Defectors and traitors like me, said a man's voice from behind them.
Auger turned to face a slender, sleekly muscled individual of uncertain age. He moved within a silver cloud of attendant machines, twinkling at the limit of vision. Auger stepped back, but the man raised a reassuring hand and closed his eyes. The cloud of machines diminished, sucked back into his paws like a time-lapse explosion in reverse. Standing before her now, he looked almost human. The latest generation of Slashers, as Auger had forgotten through her cost with Cassandra, were often indistinguishable from children. This neotenous trend was a matter of efficient resource utilization. Smaller people not only used fewer consumables, but were also easier to move around. An important factor, even given the near-limitless power of the Slasher bleed drive. But this Slasher man looked fully adult, albeit youthful. Either he predated the Neotenics and their unstable prototypes, the War Babies, or he belonged to one of the factions that retained some nostalgic bond with old-style humanity. He had flawless, unlined skin the color of honey, and liquid brown and slightly sad-looking eyes that nonetheless glittered with an easy enthusiasm. Despite the chamber being too cold for Auger's tastes, the man wore only a single layer of clothing. Simple white trousers and a white shirt, loosely cinched across his chest. "This is Niagara," said Skelsgard. "As you might have gathered, he's a citizen of the Federation of Polities." "It's all right," Niagara said. "I won't be the least bit offended if you call me a Slasher. You probably regard the term as an insult."
"Isn't it?" Auger asked, surprised.
"Only if you want it to be." Niagara made a careful gesture, like some religious benediction, a diagonal slice across his chest and a stab to the heart. "A slash and a dot," he said. "I doubt it means anything to you, but this was once the mark of an alliance of progressive thinkers linked together by one of the very first computer networks. The Federation of Polities can trace its existence right back to that fragile collective in the early decades of the Void Century. It's less a stigma than a mark of community."
"And do you care about that community?" Auger asked.
"In a broad sense, yes. But I'm not above betraying it if I think its longer-term interests are best served that way. How much do you know about the current tensions in the polities?"
"Enough.
Well, let me refresh your memory on the basics. There are now two opposing factions within the Federation, the Aggressors and the Moderates. Both parties broadly support the same goal of repairing the Earth. Where they differ is in their approach to the Usni. The Moderates are happy to negotiate access to Earth via reciprocal deals, access to the Hyperweb, licensed use of Bleed Drive and UR technologies, that sort of thing."
"Eve was only tempted by one apple," Auger said. "The Usni still remembers what your brilliant machines did to our planet."
"Nonetheless, the offer is on the table. As you'll have gathered from your dealings with Cassandra, the Moderates are serious about this proposal."
"And the Aggressors?"
"The Aggressors take the view that the Usni will never sign a deal with the Moderates, that there are too many people who think like you, Verity. So why wait for something that will never happen? Why not just take Earth now, by force?"
"They wouldn't."
"They can and they will. The only thing stopping them has been a certain trepidation, the fear that the Threshers would destroy Earth rather than let it fall into Slasher hands. A scorched Earth policy in the most literal sense. Tanglewood is more than just an orbital community. It's also a repository for enough targeted megatonnage to turn the Earth into a glowing cinder."
"So what's changed?"
"Everything," Niagara said. "For one thing, the battle planners think they may be able to take Tanglewood quickly enough to prevent those warheads from being deployed en masse. Even if they can't, the new models for repairing the Earth suggest that the warhead strike could be tolerated. We can brush radioactivity under the carpet using continental subduction zones. And when we restock the planet,
The reintroduced organisms will be modified to tolerate an enhanced level of background radiation.
Augur shuddered, imagining what that kind of tectonic reorganization implied for her beloved cities.
So an invasion is inevitable. I'm saying it is rather more likely now than it was 6 months ago. That's why some of us, moderates, have long advocated a strengthening of the Thresher position. Call it a deterrent. And it's that simple. You help us make this alien junk work, just so that we will have a chance of standing up to your own people when the shit comes down. Would it help if I made it sound more complicated than it really is? Excuse me if I don't take you at your word, Niagara, but I've only met two slashers in my life, and one of them was a lying little shit. If it's any consolation, he said, Cassandra is one of the staunchest moderates in the entire movement. If you ever needed a friend in the polities, she's it. Skelskard interposed herself between Augur and the slasher, holding up her hands as if blocking a fight. I know this comes as a shock, she said to Augur, but they really aren't all villains who'd sooner see us wiped out of existence. Believe me, I sympathize with your position, Niagara said to Augur. I know that terraforming Earth would erase your life's work. I'm simply of the opinion that the end would justify the means. Do you believe that, Niagara? That the end always justifies the means? Augur asked. Mostly, he said, and some would say that, judging by your own track record, you share something of the same philosophy. Over your dead body. Or the dead body of a boy. He shook his head. Sorry, that was uncalled for. But the point remains, you've always had a certain unflinching instinct for what needs to be done to achieve a particular outcome. I admire that, Verity. I think you have every chance of completing this mission. Now we're getting somewhere, she said. How much do you know about all this? I know that sensitive property has gone missing at the other end of that hyperweb connection, and that you are excellently equipped to recover it. Why can't you recover it? Because I don't know the territory like you do. Nor does Skelskard, or Aveling, or anyone else in this organization. The only person who did know it well enough was Susan White, and she's dead. That's a detail Kaliskan didn't quite get around to telling me. Would it have made a difference to your decision? It might. Then he was right not to mention it, but there's more to my answer than you might be aware of. It's not just that I don't know the territory. I can't even enter it. I would die if I tried. And me? You won't find it a problem. Niagara turned to face the transport that had just been loaded into the bubble. Technicians were still attending to various details around the outside, but everything about their actions suggested that all was going according to plan. You want me to get in that thing, don't you? Without a clue as to what's at the other end. It's a 30-hour journey, Niagara said. There'll be plenty of time to catch up on the way. Can I back out? It's a little late for that now, don't you think? Without waiting for an answer from Augur, he turned his attention to Skelskard. Is she ready for her language lesson? Aveling said to do it now. That way she'll have time for it to bed in before she reaches E2. What language lesson? Augur asked. Niagara raised a hand. A mist of twinkling silver machines erupted from his palm and crossed the space to Augur's head. She felt the onset of a bright, shining migraine, as if her skull was a fortress being stormed by an army in flashing chrome armor, and then she felt nothing at all. She came round to a headache, a falling sensation, and a voice in her ears speaking a language she should not be able to understand.
Wie heißt du? Ich heiße Auge. Verity Auge.
The word slipped out of her mouth with ridiculous ease.
Gut, the voice continued in English this time. Excellent, in fact. That's taken very nicely. It was Moria Skelskard speaking, sitting to her left in the confined space of what she guessed must be the hyperweb transport. On Augur's other side, in the third of the three seats, was Aveling. They were in freefall.
What's happening? Augur asked.
What's happening, Aveling said, is that you were speaking German. Niagara's little machines rewired your language, Center.
You have French as well, Skelskard added.
I already had French, Augur replied huffily. You had an academic understanding of written French skewed towards the later years of the Void Century, Skelskard corrected, but now you can really speak it.
Augur's headache intensified, as if someone had just tapped a very small tuning fork against her skull and made it ring.
I wouldn't have agreed to have this,
She wanted to say shit, but the word stalled somewhere between her brain and her voice box. This horrid stuff in me. Where the hell had horrid come from, she wondered.
It was either have it or forfeit the mission, Aveling said. In 30 hours, you'll be in Paris, acting alone, with only your wits to help you. No weapons, no comms, no AI assistance. The only help we can give you is language.
I don't want machines in my head.
In which case, Skalsgård said,
it's your lucky day. They've already been flushed out, leaving only the neural structures they created. The downside is that those structures won't last forever. 2, maybe 3 days once you get to Paris. Then they'll start eroding.
Curiosity got the better of Orga.
Why not leave the machines in, if it makes so much difference?
Same reason Niagara can't come with us, Skalsgård replied. The sensor wouldn't let them through.
The sensor?
You'll see it soon enough, Aveling said, so don't worry your pretty little head about it. That's our job.
Orga felt the buzzing, slightly brittle alertness that came with too much coffee and too much intense study. Once, about 15 years earlier, she had studied mathematics so furiously that after an evening manipulating complex bracketed equations, simplifying forms and extracting common terms, her brain had actually started to apply the same rules to spoken language, as if a sentence could be bracketed and simplified, like some quadratic formula for radioisotope decay. That was how she felt now. She only had to look at a color or shape, and her new language structures would gleefully shriek the corresponding word into her skull in a mixed cacophony of German, French, and English. I could get very angry about this.
Or you could just get over it and accept that it had to be done, Skalsgård said bluntly. I promise you there'll be no side effects.
Orga knew that it was senseless to protest any further. The machines had already come in and done their worst. The simple fact was that, had this ever been presented to her as a rational choice, she would still have chosen it over the tribunal. If that made her a hypocrite, ready to accept slasher science when it suited her, so be it.
I'm sorry if this all seems abrupt, Skalsgård said sympathetically. It's just that we really didn't have time to sit around and debate things. We needed that lost property back in safe hands as soon as possible.
Orga forced a sort of calm upon herself.
I take it we're on our way.
It was a successful insertion, Aveling said.
They were sitting 3 abreast, surrounded by instruments, controls, and fold-down panels. The technology was a curious mixture of the very robust and the very fragile-looking modern, including some equipment that had obviously come straight from slasher sources. Holding things together were bolts, nylon tie lines, and spit-like swabs of heavy-duty epoxy. Aveling had one hand on a joystick mounted on a fold-down panel in front of him. Above the panel was a flat screen, displaying a series of irregular concentric lines, like a drunkenly fashioned cobweb, with the line slowly oozing out towards the edge of the screen. Some kind of navigation system, Orga guessed, representing their flight through the hyperweb. Of the outside view nothing could be seen, since the ship's armored shutters were locked tight. It was about as exciting as a ride in an elevator.
Well, now that we're all in this together, she said, I presume you can tell me what it's all about.
What we generally find, Skalsgård said, is that it's easier if we show you. That way we skipped a whole you can't expect me to believe that shit stage.
What if I promise not to doubt a word that you say? After all, I've already seen the artifacts in Kaliskan's office. I'm pretty sure they weren't faked.
No, they were all real.
Which means they must have originated somewhere. Kaliskan said they hadn't been preserved, and yet they appeared to come from somewhere around 1959.
Which would tend to imply, Skalsgård prompted,
that you found a way back to 1959.
She paused, choosing her next words with care. Or at least something that looks a lot like 1959, even if it isn't exactly right in all the details. Is that far from the mark?
No, it's pretty close, actually.
And this version of 1959 is inside the ALS object that Peter talked about, the one he said you'd found a way into.
They told us you were good, Skalsgård said.
So where does Paris come into it?
At the end of this hyperweb is something very like Paris. You'll enter it and make contact with an individual named Blanchard.
Orga kept her voice calm, taking this one step at a time.
Someone else from the team, like White?
No, Skelskard said, glancing at Aveling. Blanchard's E2 indigenous.
Meaning what?
Meaning he grew up inside it. Meaning he has no idea he isn't living in the real Paris, on the real Earth, in the real 20th century.
Something like ice passed through Augur. How many are there like him?
About 3 billion, but don't let that put you off.
All you have to do, Aveling said, is find Blanchard and recover the item that Susan White passed to him for safekeeping. It won't be difficult. We'll give you an address, which will be within easy reach of your point of entry. Blanchard will be expecting you.
I thought you said...
Aveling cut her off. You'll pose as Susan White's sister. She'll already have told him to hand over the goods to you if you show up. Aside from anything else, that's why we needed a woman.
Augur thought for a moment, trying to assimilate all this new and puzzling information. Her mind was full of questions, but she quickly decided that, as much as she wanted to know every detail of the task, she had best begin with the basics.
And the nature of this lost property?
Just some papers in a tin, Aveling said. They'll mean nothing to Blanchard, but everything to us. You persuade Blanchard to give you the tin. You make sure the papers are inside. Then you return to us, with the papers, and we put you on the first transport home.
You make it sound so simple.
It is.
Then why do I have the nagging suspicion that there must be a catch?
Because there is, Skelskard said.
We don't know for sure what happened to Susan, but we do know that she felt threatened, and that she gave those papers to Blanchard for safekeeping. There's a chance she was murdered.
Aveling withdrew his attention from the oozing lines of the navigational display and sent Skelskard an irritated look.
She didn't need to know it was murder, he said, if it was murder.
I felt she did, Skelskard replied, shrugging.
Well, Augur said, was it murder or not?
She fell, Aveling said. That's all we know.
Or was pushed, Skelskard said darkly.
I'd really like to know which it was, Augur insisted.
It doesn't matter, Aveling said. All you need to know is that E2 is hostile territory, which is something White forgot. She was careful to begin with, they always are. Then she exceeded the remit of her mission, took risks and ended up dead.
What kind of risks?
Before Aveling could get a word in edgeways, Skelskard said, Susan felt she was onto something, something big, something significant. Because she wouldn't return to the portal, all we got from her were cryptic messages, things scribbled on postcards. If she'd at least taken the time to build a radio sender, or return to the base station, she could have told us something more concrete, but she was too busy chasing leads, and in the end it got her killed.
Supposition,
Aveling said.
If we don't think she was onto something, Skelskard said, why are we in such a hurry to get those papers back? It's because we think there might be something in them, isn't it?
It's because we can't risk cultural contamination, Aveling corrected. Analyzed with the right mindset, the papers might reveal White's origin. We don't know how indiscreet she was. Until we get the papers, we're in the dark.
Skelskard looked at Augur.
I guess all I'm saying is, take care out there, okay? Just get in and do the job. We want you back in one piece.
Really? Augur asked.
Oh, sure. Can you imagine what the return trip would be like if I only had Aveling for company?
9. It was the middle of the morning by the time Floyd returned Custine to Susan White's apartment, heavy toolkit in one hand. Custine's practicality never ceased to amaze him. The man could turn his hand to almost anything, whether it was repairing the Mathis, fixing the plumbing in their apartment, or attempting to repair the jury-rigged receiving equipment of a dead spy. Floyd knew a little about fixing boats, but that was about his limit. He had questioned Custine once about where this practicality came from, but the only explanation Custine had offered was that a certain skill with electricity and metal was very useful for an interrogator in the crime squad. That was as much as Floyd wanted to know. He waited in the car while Custine was let in, then drummed his fingers on the steering wheel for another 5 minutes, until Custine's form loomed in the fifth-floor window. Custine did not expect to get any results before the middle of the afternoon, but they had arranged to speak by telephone at 2, regardless. Floyd pulled away from Blanchard's street and drove to Montparnasse, negotiating the smaller side streets,
until he found the house where he had left Greta the night before. In daylight, the house seemed a little more cheerful, but only a little. Greta opened the door and escorted him up to the sparsely stocked kitchen that the tenant Sophie had shown him around the night before. "I called the telephone company," Floyd said. "It should be working now."
"So it is," Greta said, surprised. "Someone rang through on it only an hour ago, but I was so distracted that I didn't really think about it. How did you persuade the company to reconnect her? She still can't afford to pay them."
"I told them to put the charges on my bill."
"You did?"
She cocked her head. "That's awfully decent of you. You're not exactly rolling in money either."
"Don't worry about it. It's not as if..."
His voice trailed off.
"Not as if it'll be forever?" she finished for him.
"No, you're right. It won't be."
"I didn't mean to sound callous."
"It's all right." Now she sounded cross with herself. "I'm taking it out on whoever's within firing range. You don't deserve this."
"Don't worry about it. You're doing a pretty swell job from where I'm standing. How is Marguerite today?"
Greta spread honey onto a slice of buttered toast. "About the same as yesterday, according to Sophie. The doctor's already given her a shot of morphine for the day. I don't know why they can't give it to her later, so that she could at least get a good night's sleep."
"Maybe they're worried that she'd get too good a night's sleep," Floyd said.
"That wouldn't be such a bad thing," Greta said quietly. She was dressed all in white today, her black hair tied back in a white bow. The bow shone luminously, like something in a washing powder commercial. Greta passed him the toast, then licked her fingers clean with girlish little pops of her lips.
"Thanks for staying with me last night, Wendell," she said. "It was kind."
"You needed the company." He bit into the toast, tilting it to avoid spilling honey on his shirt. "About Marguerite. Would it be all right if I said hello to her?"
"I know what you said last night, but I really would like her to know that I care."
"She may not even remember you."
"I'm ready for that."
"Well, all right," Greta said heavily. "I suppose she's as sharp now as she'll ever be. But don't stay too long, will you? She gets tired very easily."
"I'll keep it brief."
She led him upstairs, Floyd finishing off the toast as he went. The floorboards creaked as he made his way across the landing. Greta eased open the bedroom door, slipped inside and spoke very softly to Marguerite. Floyd heard the old woman answer in French. She spoke nothing else, not even German. She had been born in the Alsace region, Greta had told him once, and had married a German cabinet maker who had died in the mid-30s. At home they had spoken only French. When things became difficult for Greta's family in Germany, Greta was Jewish on her mother's side. They had dispatched her to live with Marguerite. She had arrived in Paris in the summer of 1939 when she was 9 years old, and had lived in the city for most of the last 20 years. There had been a great deal of anti-German sentiment after the failed invasion of 1940, but Greta had weathered most of it, speaking French with a pronounced Parisian accent that revealed nothing of her true origins. On first meeting her, Floyd had never guessed that she was German. The disclosure of that secret to him had been the first of many intimacies, each of which had brought a small, stabbing thrill of mutual trust. She called to him from inside the room. "You can come in now, Floyd." The door opened wider to reveal Sophie, who was just leaving, carrying a tray with her. He stepped aside to let her pass, then walked into the shuttered quiet of the bedroom. There were subtle squares and oblongs on the walls, where paintings, photographs, and mirrors had been taken down. The bed had been made neatly around Marguerite, presumably in readiness for the doctor's visit, and the old lady was now sitting almost upright, supported by 3 or 4 plump pillows. She wore a high-collared, long-sleeved floral nightgown that seemed to belong to the 19th century. Her white hair had been combed back from her brow, and her cheeks dabbed lightly with rouge. Floyd could just about make out Marguerite's face in the muted light, but what he saw was a thin, cursory sketch of the woman he had known. He thought it would have been easier if there had been no similarity at all, but she was recognizable, and that made it all the more difficult.
"This is Wendell," Greta said gently. "You remember Wendell, don't you, Aunt?"
Floyd presented himself, holding his fedora in both hands like an offering.
"Of course I remember him," Marguerite said. Her eyes were surprisingly bright and clear. "How are you, Floyd?" "We always called you Floyd rather than Wendell, didn't we?"
"I'm doing swell," he said, shuffling his feet. "How are you feeling?"
"I'm all right now."
Her voice was a rasp,
He had to concentrate to make out her words.
But the nights are difficult. I never imagined sleeping could take so much energy from me. I'm not sure how much I have left.
You're a strong lady, he said. I'm sure you've got a lot more energy than you think. She placed one of her thin bird-like hands atop the other and rested them on her stomach. The newspaper was spread across her lap like a shawl, open at the Parisian news pages.
I wish I felt that were true.
She knows, Floyd thought. She might have been frail, and she might not always have quite this good a grip on what was happening around her, but she knew perfectly well that she was ill, and that her illness was never going to let her leave this room.
What's it like outside, Floyd?
Marguerite asked.
I listened to the rain all night.
It's clearing up a bit, he said. The sun's coming out and... His mouth suddenly felt dry. Why had he insisted on this visit? He had nothing to say to Marguerite that she must not already have heard 100 times before, from similarly well-intentioned visitors. He realized with a spasm of shame that he hadn't come up here to make her feel better, but to make himself feel better instead. He was going to stand before her and never once allude to the fact that she was terminally ill, as if there was an elephant in the room that no one dared acknowledge.
Well,
he said, fumbling for words, it's beautiful when the sun comes out. The whole city looks like a painting.
The colors must be beautiful. I've always loved the spring. It's nearly as breathtaking as the autumn.
I don't think there's a time of year when I don't love this city, Floyd said, except perhaps January.
Greta reads the paper to me,
Marguerite said, patting the pages spread before her.
She only wants to read the light news, but I want to know it all, the bad as well as the good. I don't envy you, young people.
Floyd smiled, trying to remember the last time anyone had called him young. Things don't seem too bad to me, he said.
You weren't here in the '30s, were you?
No, I wasn't.
Then, with all due respect, you probably have no idea what it was really like.
Greta glanced at him warningly, but Floyd shrugged good-naturedly.
No,
I have no idea.
It was good in many ways, Marguerite said. The depression was over. We all had more money. There was more to eat, nicer clothes, music we could dance to. We could afford a car and a holiday in the country once a year, a wireless and a gramophone, even a refrigerator. But there was also a meanness to those times. There was always an undercurrent of hatred bubbling just beneath the surface.
She turned her head towards her niece.
It was hatred that brought Greta to Paris.
The fascists got what they deserved, Floyd said.
My husband lived long enough to see those monsters come to power. He saw through their lies and promises, but he also knew that they spoke to something nasty and squalid in the human spirit, something in all of us. We want to hate those who are not like us. All we need is an excuse, a whisper in the ear.
Not all of us, Floyd said.
That's what a lot of good people said in the '30s, Marguerite replied. That the message of hatred would only be heeded by the ignorant and those who were already filled with bile. But it wasn't like that. It took strength of mind not to let yourself be poisoned by those lies. And not everyone had that strength. Even fewer people had the courage to do something about it, to actually stand up to the hate mongers.
Was your husband one of those brave people? Floyd asked.
No,
she said.
He wasn't. He was one of the millions who said and did nothing, and that's how he went to his grave.
Floyd did not know what to say. He looked at the woman in the bed, feeling the force of history streaming through her like a current.
All I'm saying, she continued, is that the message is seductive. My husband said that unless those hate mongers were annihilated, wiped from the earth, along with all their poison, they would always come back like weeds.
She touched the newspaper on the bed.
The weeds are returning, Floyd. We mowed the lawn in 1940, but we didn't put down the weed killer. 20 years later, they're back.
I know there are a lot of people saying bad things, Floyd said, but no one really takes them seriously.
No one took them seriously in the '20s,
she countered. There are laws now, Floyd said, anti-hate laws,
which aren't enforced.
She tapped the paper with one sharp-nailed finger.
Look at this story. A young man was beaten to death yesterday
because he dared to speak up against the hatemongers.
Floyd's voice suddenly sounded as weak as Marguerite's.
A young man.
By the railway station. They found his body last night.
No.
Greta slipped her hand around his sleeve.
We should be going now, Floyd.
He couldn't say anything. Marguerite folded the paper and pushed it from the bed.
I didn't mean to lecture you,
she said, with a kindness that cut him to the core. I just wanted to say how little I envy you now.
There were storm clouds on the horizon 20 years ago, Floyd, and they're gathering again.
Almost as an afterthought, she said,
of course, it's not too late to do something about them, if enough people care. I wonder how many people walked past that poor young man last night, when he was in need of help.
Greta edged him away from the bed.
Floyd has to go now, Aunt Marguerite.
She reached out and took his hand.
It was nice of you to come up and see me. You'll come back, won't you?
Of course, Floyd said, forcing a smile to disguise his discomfort.
Bring me some strawberries, won't you? This room could do with brightening up.
I'll bring you some strawberries, he promised. Greta led him downstairs, still holding his arm.
That's how it is with her, she said, when they were safely out of earshot. She's sharp as a tack about the news, but she doesn't even know what time of year it is.
You're lucky she remembered who you were. Let's just hope she doesn't remember asking for strawberries.
I'll find her something.
At this time of year? Don't worry about it, Floyd. She most likely won't remember a thing about it the next time you go up there.
If she sounded cruel, Floyd thought, it was only because she loved Marguerite so much.
They sat down in the kitchen again. A pigeon was cooing on the windowsill. Greta picked up a piece of stale bread and threw it at the glass, scaring the bird away in a bustle of grey feathers.
It might not be the same young man, she said, guessing what was on Floyd's mind. Maybe you don't read the papers these days, but people are always getting beaten up.
We both know it was the same kid, so why pretend otherwise?
We went over this last night. If you tried to do anything, they'd have cut you up.
The old me might have tried.
The old you would have had more sense.
You're just trying to make me feel better about it. Floyd looked up at the ceiling, picturing the bedroom he had just visited, the ordered placement of its furniture and the stillness of its occupant. She might not have much of a grip on the time of year, but she knows how things are going.
Maybe it's not as bad as she fears. Old people always think the world's going to ruin. It's their job.
Maybe they're right, Floyd replied. Greta bent down to pick up the bread she had just thrown at the pigeon.
Perhaps they are, and maybe that's as good a reason as any to think about leaving Paris.
Nice segue.
I don't suppose you've given any more thought to what we talked about.
I mentioned it to Christine, Floyd said.
How did he take it?
He took it well, the same way he takes everything.
Andre's a good man, Greta said. I'm sure he'd do a fine job of running the agency.
He'd probably have Paris eating out of his hand within the year.
So why not give him the chance? I've been here 20 years, Floyd said. If I leave now, am I saying that the last 20 years of my life were a mistake? Only if you want to think of them that way.
I'm not sure there's any other way.
It's not the same city you arrived in, Greta said. Things have changed, and not many of them for the better. It wouldn't be an admission of defeat. How old are you now, Floyd? 39? 40? It's not so old. Not if you don't want it to be.
Have you had a chance to look at the papers in that box?
Nice segue yourself, she said, allowing him a tolerant smile. All right. We'll talk about it later. Yes. I have looked in the box.
Anything you can tell me?
Can we talk about it somewhere else? Greta said. This place is getting to me. Sophie's here for the rest of the morning. I could really use some fresh air.
Floyd reached for his fedora.
Then let's go for a stroll.
Floyd found a place to park the Mathis on Rue de Rivoli, near the Louvre. The rain had given up for now, although the clouds on the edge of the city had the inky look of thunder about them. But it was pleasant enough on the right bank, with the sun doing its utmost to dry the pavements and provide some late-season business for the ice cream vendors. It was one of those autumn days that Floyd never took for granted, knowing that there might not be another like it before winter stole slyly in.
Well, he said, feeling his mood improve, what's it going to be? Culture or a stroll in the Tuileries?
Culture?
You wouldn't know Calci if it bit you on the nose. Anyway, I said I wanted some fresh air. The paintings can wait. They've been there long enough. Suits me. More than a half an hour in any public institution, and I start feeling like one of the exhibits. Greta took the biscuit tin with her, tucking it under one arm as they walked. The Tuileries Gardens ran between the museum and Place de la Concorde, stretching in an elegant formal ribbon along the right bank. They had been part of the city since the time of Catherine de' Medici, 400 years earlier. It always amazed Floyd to think of these geometric green spaces enduring through all the changes that had overtaken Paris in that time. The gardens were one of Floyd's favorite places in the city, especially on a quiet morning in the middle of the week. Deck chairs had been positioned around the large octagonal basin at the western end of the gardens. Greta and Floyd found themselves a pair of adjacent chairs and started scattering the scraps of stale bread she had rescued from the kitchen. "I don't know what you want me to make of this," Greta said, tapping the tin. "I mean, if you go looking for something odd or unusual, you're almost bound to find it. Tell me what you have. I'll worry about making sense of it. What was the name of the woman again? Susan something? I have her Christian name on the postcard, that's all." "Susan White," Floyd said, "if that was her real name." "You're really convinced she was up to something?" "More than I was yesterday. Christine's still trying to make sense of what she did to the wireless set in her room." "Well," Greta said, "I don't mind admitting that this is as good a way as any to take my mind off my aunt. Whatever helps." Floyd tore off a chunk of stale crust and tossed it to a gathering of anxious, squabbling male ducks. "Come on, then. What have you got for me?" "I can't help you with the maps and sketches, but I might be able to shed some light on this." She fished in the tin until she found the letter printed on headed paper. "That's the one from the steelworks in Berlin?" Floyd asked. "Caspar Metals, yes. So what's it all about?" "All I have to go on is this one letter," Greta said, "so there's necessarily some guesswork involved. But it looks to me as if Susan White got wind of a contract that Caspar Metals was handling. Not one she had a role in herself." "No, definitely looks as if there's a third party involved. Judging from the letter, White must have already dug up some information about this contract, enough that she wouldn't look like a complete outsider." A small, formal party approached the duck pond. There were 8 or 9 suited men, all wearing trilbies, surrounding an elderly man in a wheelchair who was being pushed along by a sturdy nurse. "Tell me about the contract," Floyd said. "Well, it doesn't go into any great detail. That must have been covered in an earlier letter. But it looks as if the firm was being asked to cast a big solid chunk of aluminium. 3 big chunks, actually. And the quote talks about additional costs for machining to the desired spherical shape." Floyd watched the old man in the wheelchair throw bread into the pond with trembling hands, drawing the ducks away. "There was a diagram in the tin," he said. "Something round. Must have been part of the same caboodle." "You look disappointed," she remarked. "Only because I thought we might be onto something, that maybe the plan was for a bomb. But if the casting is solid..." He shrugged. "There's some talk about the objects forming part of an artistic installation, but that could be a cover." "None of this makes any sense," Floyd said. "If she was an American spy, why would she have needed a German firm to make those things, no matter what they're meant for? There must be 100 American firms that could have done the same work." "Look," Greta said, "just suppose for a minute that she was a spy. What do they do apart from spying? They also keep tabs on the activities of other spies." "Agreed," Floyd said. "But what if she was put here to keep her eye on another operation? White finds out something about the Berlin contract. She doesn't necessarily know all the details, but she knows she has to find out more about it. So she writes to Caspar Metals, posing as someone connected to the organization that arranged the initial order." "Possible," Floyd allowed. Greta tossed some more bread into the duck pond. "Actually, there is another thing I should mention." "Go on." "The letter also covers costs for transportation and delivery of the finished goods. Now, this is the interesting part. It was broken down into 3 separate billing items, somewhere in Berlin, somewhere in Paris, and somewhere in Milan. I don't remember seeing addresses in that letter." "You didn't. The man who wrote the letter must have assumed that both parties already had that information."
Floyd had been wondering where the Milan connection would come in. Except we don't have that information, he said. All we have is a couple of lines on a map of Europe. He remembered the L-shaped figure, with the neatly marked distances between the three cities. I still don't know what the markings on that map mean, but they obviously relate to the work being done by that factory in some way.
One last thing, Greta said. That train ticket. It was for the overnight express to Berlin, and it hasn't been used.
Is there a date on the ticket?
Issued on September 15th for travel from Gare du Nord on the 21st. She'd reserved a sleeping compartment.
She died on the 20th, Floyd said, recalling the details in his notebook. Blanchard said that she gave him the tin on the 15th or 16th. He couldn't be sure which. She must have booked the ticket and never used it. I wonder why she didn't simply get on the first train to Berlin, rather than book passage on one that wasn't due to leave for 4 or 5 days. Maybe she had other business she had to attend to first. Or maybe she'd called ahead and made an arrangement to visit the factory on a particular day. Either way, she knew she wasn't getting on that train for a few days. But she also knew she was in danger, and that the tin might fall into the wrong hands.
Has it occurred to you, Floyd, that if someone killed her because of what was in that tin, they might do it again?
The party with the elderly man had retreated from the duck pond, the wheelchair crunching away across the graveled promenade in the general direction of the Orangerie. Beyond the party, looming above the trees lining the Seine, the slick wet roof of the Gare d'Orsay on the left bank shone in the sunlight. Despite its name, it was many years since the Gare d'Orsay had been a railway station. There had been vague plans to turn it into a museum, but in the end, the city authorities had decided that the most effective use of the grand old building would be as a prison for high-profile political detainees. Seeing the prison, something tugged at his memory, some elusive connection waiting to be completed. He dished out the remainder of the bread to the few ducks that had stayed loyal. I know there are risks, but I can't just drop the case because some people might not want me to succeed. Greta studied him carefully. How much does this dogged determination have to do with what Marguerite just told you?
Hey, Floyd said defensively.
This isn't about anything other than getting a job done for a client. A job that happens to pay pretty well, I might add. So that's all it boils down to. Money.
Money and curiosity, he admitted.
No amount of money will make up for a broken neck. Take what you have and go to the authorities. Give them all the evidence and let them piece things together.
Now you sound like Christine.
Maybe he has a point. Think about it, Floyd. Don't get in too deep. You're a big man, but you're not a strong swimmer.
I'll know when I'm in too deep, he said.
Greta shook her head.
I know you too well. You'll only realize you're in too deep when you start drowning. But what's the point of arguing?
I'm hungry. Let's walk to the Champs-Élysées. There's a place there that does good pancakes. You can buy me an Eskimo ice cream along the way. Then you can take me back to Montparnasse. Floyd surrendered, offering her a hand. They set off in the direction of the avenue, Floyd watching as the wind whipped up in the distance and hoisted someone's umbrella into the sky.
How's the band going? Greta asked.
The band ceased to exist when you left, Floyd said. Since then we've not exactly been snowed under with offers.
I was only ever one part of it.
You're a damned good singer, and a damned good guitar player. You left a big hole.
You and Christine are both good musicians.
Good doesn't cut it.
Well then, you're better than good.
Christine, maybe.
It's not as if you're the worst bass player in the world either. You always knew you could make it work if you only wanted it badly enough.
I make the moves. I can lay down a pretty steady beat.
You say that like it's a bad thing. There are 100 bands in Nice who could use a bass player like you, Floyd.
But I can't do anything you haven't seen before. I can't make it new.
Not everyone wants it new.
But that's the point. All we ever do is play the same old swing numbers in the same old way. I'm tired of it. Christine can barely bring himself to take out his saxophone.
So do something different.
Christine keeps trying. You know how he was always trying to get us to play that fast 8-beat stuff? When all we ever wanted to do was stay in 4-4?
Maybe Christine was onto something.
He heard a guy playing here a few years ago, Floyd said. Some heroin fiend from Kansas City. Looked 60, but he was really about my age. Called himself Yard Hound or Yard Dog or something. He kept playing that crazy improvisational stuff,
like it was the wave of the future. But no one wanted to know. Except Christine. Christine said it was the music he'd always had in his head. So find a way to help him play it.
Too fast for me, Floyd said. And anyway, even if it wasn't, no one else wants to hear it. It's not stuff you can dance to.
You shouldn't give up that easily, Greta admonished.
It's too late. They don't even want straight jazz anymore. Half the clubs we played last year are out of business now. Maybe it's different in the States, but...
Some people won't ever get it, Greta said. They don't want to see black people and white people getting along, let alone playing the same music, because there's always a danger that the world might actually become a better place because of it.
Floyd smiled.
Your point being? Those of us who care shouldn't give up that easily. Maybe we need to stick our necks out from time to time.
I stick my neck out for no one.
Not even for the music you love?
Maybe there was a time when I used to think jazz could save the world, Floyd said. But I'm older and wiser now.
Walking the gravel path, they passed the party with the elderly man again, and something in Floyd's head clicked like a key in a well-oiled lock. Maybe it was the conversation he'd had with Marguerite, or perhaps the juxtaposition of the man and the political prison across the river. But Floyd suddenly recognized him. The man lolled forward in the wheelchair, his jaw slack, a thin worm of drool curling down his chin. His skin was glued to his skull like a single layer of papier-mâché. His hands trembled with some kind of palsy. Beneath his blanket, it was said that the doctors had hacked away more than they had left behind. Whatever trickled through his veins was now more chemical than blood. But he had survived the cancers, just as he had survived the assassination attempt in May 1940, when the advance into the Ardennes had come to an inglorious end. The shape of the face was still recognizable, along with the outdated priggish little mustache and the vain swoop of thinning hair, white now, where once it had been black. It was almost 20 years since his ambitions had crashed and burnt during that disastrous summer. In the carnival of monsters that the century had produced, he was only one amongst many. He talked hate back then, but who hadn't? Hate was how you made things happen in those years. It was the lever that moved things. It didn't necessarily mean he believed it, or that he would have been any worse for France than any of the men who had come after him. Who could begrudge him a morning in the Tuileries Gardens, after all the time he had served in the Garde d'Orsay? He was just a sad old man now, less a figure of revulsion than one of pity. Let him feed the ducks. Floyd?
What?
You were miles away.
Years away, he said. Not quite the same thing.
She steered him towards an ice cream stand. Floyd dug into his pocket for a few coins.